You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
7 years ago, New Zealand suffered the worst terrorist attack in its history when an Australian white nationalist entered two different mosques in the city of Christchurch and shot 51 Muslim worshippers to death, injuring 89 others. Last week, a new book was published entitled He Told Us, co-written by Chris Wilson and Mikhail Dzhivulski. The book documents the life of the terrorist and the lead-up to the attack, the ideologies and online communities that influenced him, the atrocities he committed on the day, and the aftermath, with a focus on the Royal Commission and its limitations. Dr. Chris Wilson is an associate professor in politics and international relations at the University of Auckland, and Mikhail Dzhivulski is a researcher currently studying a master's degree in conflict and terrorism studies, also at the University of Auckland. They joined me in the studio this morning to discuss what we've learned and what we failed to learn from this horrendous attack. To begin with the basics, what is He Told Us actually about, and how do you hope that the publication of this book will affect the public's understanding of the events that took place on the 15th of March 2019?
The book is really a a comprehensive picture of the attack and the perpetrator, and how and who he was, why he committed that atrocity. And the white nationalist, you know, transnational and but particularly Australian white nationalist movement that of which he was a part, and the online spaces that he inhabited and the effect that they have on people, his attack, and then the investigation and the Royal Commission of Inquiry that followed after it, which was supposed to be a comprehensive inquiry into how he was able to plan his attack and conduct it, and was there anything that could have been done to stop it? That's what was initially announced. But you know, as we show in the book, that the terms of the inquiry were narrowed substantially to make it that we really learned nothing. And so by the time we started, we looked at the Royal Commission report and went, our knowledge of what has happened here is really, really incomplete. So we set to work trying to find him, trying to find his online record, trying to understand him properly. And we hope that that information, on the second part of your question, we hope that that information changes New Zealanders' understanding of what happened, who he was, why he did what he did, and what could be done in the future to stop similar atrocities. And also globally as well. It's the most influential far-right terrorist attack now that's occurred, and continues to inspire other people, incite other people to violence across the world, so we have to understand it.
I feel like everybody knows in broad strokes what happened that day, but there's so much detail that people just don't know. I finished reading the book today and I learned so many pieces of detail that I had no idea about before. Now, we will come to the inquiry at the end and some of the research that you did, but before that, I just want to ask about how you decided to talk about the terrorist and refer to him as an individual. People will remember that in the immediate aftermath of the attack, most of the media followed the example set by Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and avoided referring to the terrorist by name. In your book, you mostly followed this example, simply referring to him as the terrorist. However, you don't completely censor his name either and use it a number of times throughout the book. What are the advantages and disadvantages of referring to perpetrators of terrorist acts by name? And what was the rationale for the approach that you used in the book?
So it's broadly understood that, you know, you don't use the perpetrator's name because that can lead to glorification of the person and the act. But that is also sort of based on quite an old understanding from legacy media days, where there was a single sort of point of news. So people would sort of hear about something happening and then it would be broadcast through there. Things have changed a lot with social media. So even if there's a censorship of the name and of certain details in sort of legacy media and mainstream media, there's a lot of channels out there where the details and the information can be spread anyway. So there's kind of these two worlds that exist. And so we had to sort of acknowledge that and go, what's the understanding that that most people have of the attack? There's a lot of good work that's been done, and we wanted to put all that information in the book. But in order to give a complete picture of what happened, we had to sort of go further than had been done previously.
You also talk in the book about these two kind of parallel worlds that exist. One in which the name is buried and suppressed and almost forgotten, yeah. And another world of far-right online spaces where he's almost deified and glorified. and referred to as a saint.
Yeah, there's that. I guess the other important point is also that, you know, when you have the leader of the country sort of stepping up and saying, we're not going to say his name, we're not going to do it. There's an unintended consequence there around giving people permission to turn away from what happened.
Mm.
And by not saying his name, you're not going to look at what happened, you're not going to examine it. And so we feel that that's contributed to a forgetting of what happened. And many of the families and the community that we spoke to felt the same way.
But, and I would just add that, but as you say, we do stick to that guideline out of respect for the families. Mm-hmm. We don't believe that it's particularly effective in preventing him being glorified, but we do want to pay our respects to the families by not having his name repeated throughout the book.
There are a couple of other euphemisms that have been used to refer to him, the Christchurch terrorist or the individual, and I know that you have problems with both of those terms. Could you just briefly explain why?
Yes, that's right. So the individual and the Christchurch terrorist, in the Royal Commission of Inquiry uses the term the individual. A lot of media uses the, and, you know, most commentators, I guess, is very widely use the term Christchurch terrorist. We decided not to use either of those. The Christchurch terrorist we don't use because he had no association with that city before driving in. He was in the city for an hour, you know, before his attack. And so that's kind of like tainting Christchurch with him. And then the individual is used in the Royal Commission of Inquiry has an implication that he was a completely lone actor and he was not associated with anybody else. So that's kind of like provides an assumption that then colours analysis from that point on. So we move away from that term. We don't agree with that term.
That's interesting because that points to two different questions that are raised in this book. One, you know, to what extent did he actually act alone? And the other, where did he come from? And I want to start with that second question. So in this book, you frequently emphasize the Australian-ness of the terrorist. The subtitle of the book is How an Australian Committed Far-Right Terrorism in Christchurch, New Zealand. And the longest chapter of the book deals specifically with the background of white nationalism in Australia. But given that you also emphasize how in the age of the smartphone, white nationalism is an increasingly international phenomenon, how significant is the nationality of the terrorist really? And do you think that a similar act could not have been carried out by somebody born and raised in this country?
I think both things can be really important simultaneously, and both of them played off each other. The transnational and online nature of white nationalism across the globe, but also him being an Australian, being a proud Australian, emphasising his Australianness online, and being deeply connected and excited by a rising Australian far-right movement. A number of organisations growing in size, becoming more militant, holding rallies, preventing the building of mosques, gaining a lot of media, having a couple of charismatic leaders. All of these things excited him, and you could see that reflected in his online posting in anonymous transnational forums. So the two things played off each other, almost like his online world, which was this anonymous forum, 4chan, and particularly the poll Politically Incorrect board, was crucial to his radicalisation towards militancy and the attack. But he was also being excited by these offline events back in his home country. So they were both kind of like almost like a double helix type effect in terms of pushing him towards the attack.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course, somebody, you know, these types of attacks occur in many countries that people can radicalise and see, you know, people within, because it's transnational, people get influenced by attacks in other countries, get influenced by events and ideas that come from other countries. So there are young white males, mostly, who are radicalising in most of these countries. But this particular individual was heavily driven by that Australian white nationalist movement. It's important to the Royal Commission of Inquiry almost ignores that connection, almost treats it as if it was inconsequential.
Hmm.
I think that's partly because they don't recognise that people can be an active member and influenced by that movement just through online interaction. They don't need to be meeting face-to-face. It's like in 2018, 17, when he was preparing his attack, online membership is that's the most common and even most powerful membership of a far right group like that. And he was an active member of the United Patriots Front and then LAD Society. Lots of posting, adored the leaders, was encouraged by them, felt like he was gaining status from that movement, you know, through Facebook posts and engagement. But for some reason, the inquiry just treated it as if he's not a member of that, not a true member of that group. And so therefore, that movement wasn't particularly influential on who he was and why he did what he did. And we make the point in the book that when it comes to young Muslim men who might just say, I was inspired by ISIS, and they find an ISIS flag, all of a sudden he was driven by ISIS. He was inspired by ISIS, and that's why he committed the attack. The terrorist who attacked the Muslim community in Christchurch had a far deeper connection with the Australian far-right movement, and that was treated as if it didn't matter.
What was the organisation that he was specifically asked to become a member of?
It's called the LAD Society.
Okay.
Which is, just for context for your listeners, the LAD Society is led by a former New Zealander who moved to Australia a long time ago, Thomas Sewell, who formed the LAD Society out of the United Patriots Front, which was more radical than the UPF. He asked the terrorists to join, and he did become an active online member. The LAD Society then became the National Socialist Network, NSN, which, you know, many of you might have seen black-clad neo-Nazis marching around in Victoria, doing Nazi salutes and so on. Mm-hmm. And has now morphed into something even more radical. And Thomas Sewell has been facing numerous court charges and has become a, you know, that was a growing movement. And that was a key driver on why the terrorists committed his attack.
So does anything equivalent to that exist in New Zealand, or is there just a much bigger problem of, you know, far-right white nationalists, neo-Nazis in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, we have groups, but they're nowhere near as big. Mm-hmm. Action Zealandia would be the most similar important group in New Zealand, but nowhere near as large, influential as LAD Society in Australia or the UPF or, you know, the various groups, NSN.
And coming back to your point about Australia and how important that is, so, you know, he grew up in Australia. As he travelled, you know, he maintained a very strong Australian identity, and he was involved with all these Australian groups. When the Royal Commission of Inquiry looked into it, they didn't critique Australian security agencies. They go into detail of the history of, you know, New Zealand agencies and, you know, what happened in the 1960s for these, you know, NZSIS and all of that. But they just let off the security agencies from Australia with a simple thing of just, you know, they told us that they didn't know anything about him, they didn't have any intelligence on him, and they sort of leave it at that. And Australia itself hasn't had any sort of reckoning with this terrorist or this event. So the fact that it happened in New Zealand is just, that's just a target that he chose. Mm. But the way that he came to all of this is through Australia, and a lot of those questions around what Australian agencies were doing and whether what they were monitoring at that time while he was involved in those groups, while he was posting online, that hasn't been examined publicly.
Mm-hmm. So the idea of him being a lone actor in New Zealand misses the point that he was a member of these international networks, and particularly these Australian groups online.
Absolutely, and we indicate that there are a number of other indications that he could have been talking to any number of people, because yeah. There was a number of platforms that he had on his phone, had on his computer at home.
Discord
in particular, which is the go-to platform for the far right at that time, but which was not even investigated. So it's really nigh on impossible to draw the conclusion that he involved no other person in the planning or preparation of his attack if you haven't looked at who he was speaking to and what he was speaking about.
Michal, you mentioned his travel. One aspect of the terrorist life that I was pretty surprised to learn about was his overseas travel. So correct me if I have the facts wrong, but I believe after the suicide of his father in 2010, he inherited a large sum of money, about $500,000, which he then used to travel across Europe, Asia and Africa, including several Muslim-majority countries. So what do we know about the terrorist's activity during his time overseas, and how did that contribute to the shaping of his worldview, and was he in contact with any other far-right actors in those countries?
Yeah, I mean, our primary source of information is the Royal Commission of Inquiry, which only discusses his travel in a few pages, really. So there's very little known about, you know, what he was doing in each particular country, and he travelled to 60 different countries, including North Korea, Iran, Russia, Ukraine. He went to a whole bunch of places.
So that didn't raise any flags when he was applying for a firearms license, or?
No, so that wasn't part of that at all. And that, you know, with that comparison earlier of what it would have been like for a young Muslim man who was arriving in the country and applying for a license, those sorts of travel destinations probably would have raised some eyebrows and some other questions would have been asked. But for the terrorist, that just wasn't a concern. And that also emboldened him, we feel, you know, as he was traveling through different places and not being questioned and just... you know, stating that he was going to commit violence online and that the Australian government couldn't stop him, that just made him more and more, I guess, certain that he could commit an attack. And so then when he got to planning and he was a lot more confident.
Mm-hmm. He sort of had these fantasies about starting another war in former Yugoslavia. Was he posting from... the former Yugoslavia when he was talking about those things?
Yeah, so he was in Croatia at one point, and the travel was really important for us determining and figuring out his anonymous online posts, because he had travelled to all these different countries, and on 4chan you can see the country that somebody is posting from. So, you know, at one point he was in Croatia and he had a whole lengthy discussion with other extremists, and in those posts he was saying, I want to form a band of militants, and I'll pay for their weapons and travel to Croatia, to the Balkans, and we'll form a small militia, and we'll go and kill people there. And in those posts, that's when he was saying, I'm Australian, the Australian government can't do anything to stop me. And he also just, you know, then would talk about places he'd been to, other places that he'd travelled to, which then we were able to match with his travel itinerary.
Let's talk about that in more detail. So you include in the book many posts made on online forums, particularly 4chan, and particularly the poll board, the politically incorrect board. And one of the features of that board is that next to every post or comment, it displays the flag of the country that the person is in. And you were able to use known information about where he was traveling to determine that it was likely the terrorist who made these posts. Could you just tell us a bit more about the kind of forensics behind that and how you've identified those posts as being authored by him?
The main things are for the forensic linguistic side of it is, you know, he would not put a space after certain punctuation. So after a full stop or comma, he would omit putting a space in. So that was quite a rare sort of grammatical quirk that we noticed. He would use certain words. He would contract certain words together, like as well or at least, which was also uncommon. So we had a whole bunch of markers that we were able to put together for the forensic linguistic side of things, and then look at those countries that he travelled in, look at the travel dates, and then just look at the 4chan posts on the politically incorrect board that has those flags on there, and then narrow it down and then find what we were then able to say is most certainly him. Right up until he was in New Zealand, where, you know, posting under a New Zealand flag, he would talk about mosques in the South Island, that he had plans to commit violence, all the way up until the 14th of March, where he posted the day before his attack about a school shooting that occurred in Brazil. And on that post, he added an image, because 4chan is an image board. So he added an image there that was also the same image that he had used on his Facebook profile. And when we took those two images and looked at them together, they were the exact same. So we were able to look at the metadata there and determine that that was him also.
One of the big questions raised in the book, and we've already touched on it so far, is the extent to which the terrorist actually acted alone. We know that he was the only shooter active on that particular day in the city, despite some confused comments that he made to police. But you raised the possibility that he may have been aided by others in the lead-up to the shootings in quite a direct way. So what evidence do we actually have to suggest that he may not have been completely alone?
So he conducted the attack alone. We have no doubt about that. At the time, as you say, he said there are 20 shooters, so there are 9 shooters. And then eventually during the police interrogation that day got down to not we, started using the term I, and then, you know, basically admitted that he had acted alone. From that moment, that seems to have coloured the understanding of him. And he was treated as if, yes, he certainly committed the attack, but everything that the investigation found from that moment on indicated that he had prepared and planned and bought his weapons and funded himself and done everything himself. The problem for us that we identify in the book is that that conclusion is drawn incredibly confidently, and it's such a crucial conclusion, but it was done so in the absence of really crucial information, i.e. What was his online record? What were the forums he was engaged in? Was he talking to other people about his violence? We demonstrate that yes, he was. We show that he, in study of terrorism, we use the term leakage. He leaked his plans. He told on 2 occasions in New Zealand, I have a plan to attack mosques in the South Island. We draw the inference that if he was saying that in a public forum, imagine what he was saying privately. So let's consider what the private messaging platforms that he was using. We know, we demonstrate, and the Royal Commission knew that he had Discord, that he had any number of other messaging apps, but there's no evidence from those. So he had these, and in sum, the Royal Commission of Inquiry knows and tells us that he downloaded those messaging apps in the days and weeks before his attack, i.e. onto his phone. So he downloaded those onto his phone in preparation for departure from Dunedin to Christchurch to commit his attack, clearly as part of his preparation for the attack. But no information given about what he used those apps for, who he was messaging with, what he was discussing. So our main conclusion is that there are heavy indications that he was talking to other people about his violence. So therefore, it's quite likely that he was probably talking, that he was talking more explicitly to some people and saying he had a plan, and some people were, you know, and there may have been people that he was talking to about where he should attack, what sort of attack he should conduct, how he should do it, how he should disseminate his propaganda, and so on. Our main criticism is that the conclusion was drawn without that he was a completely lone actor that had involved no other person, without the evidence to do it. If you haven't got his online record and you're talking about an online, you know, a digital native, a person who spent all his time online and had no relationships offline, then you need to have that that online record. At the same time, as we point out in the book, he had everything was planned to a T, right? Like everything, he had every detail planned, and he had numerous file sharing sites to share his manifesto. This was how he wanted his attack to be understood. He was really, really careful about making sure that his propaganda spread afterwards. And then but we are led to believe, and we're told by the Royal Commission, that his recording, the live stream and the recording, was just left to chance on whether people would actually download it and disseminate it. It seems very unlikely to us for somebody who planned everything else. His manifesto was contained in something like 9 file sharing sites, plus on a USB and so on. He destroyed his hard drive to make sure that they couldn't see who he'd been speaking to and what he'd been doing. He planned everything else really, really carefully, but for the live stream, he didn't tell somebody that he was about to record a massacre and make sure that you download that recording. To us, it seems unlikely, but the most important thing that we can say is that the inquiry drew conclusions that it was not in a place to draw, because it didn't have the evidence about his online record.
Given how thorough he was in planning the attack, and we know from looking at his travel itineraries that he was a very detailed focused person who planned every single thing out in a lot of detail. The video recording, there are a couple of question marks around that, because firstly, he only had 3 Facebook friends who could have seen that live stream on Facebook, just being a Facebook friend of his. And also the recording cuts out while he's in transit from the first site of the attack to the second. Do you have any hypotheses about, you know, that might explain these apparent gaps in his plan?
So the main way that it's understood is he posted a link to his Facebook page on 8chan right before his attack. His planning documents were saying, you know, that he wanted to post it to 4chan and 8chan, but on the day there's only a record of him doing it to 8chan. So he was just leaving it to chance, basically, that the extremist community would sort of see his post and take it seriously and go to his Facebook and see the live stream there. On the day, there were some things that, you know, the systems that Facebook had for detecting this kind of violence and stopping it from being broadcast on live streams and just on videos, it didn't work, completely failed. So the live stream was broadcast for the full 17 minutes and then didn't, and then remained there for, you know, up to an hour afterwards before somebody reported it and before it was taken down. So, but the terrorists couldn't have known that that was going to be the case. So there's also, in his planning documents that are in the Royal Commission, there are references to, you know, SMS at this time with the attack. You know, these indicators that are also there about him downloading Discord, downloading Skype, using different types of messaging apps and putting them on his phone, which he would then have use of on the day of his attack. So putting all of that information together and seeing also, you know, how prolific he was in talking about what he was going to do publicly on anonymous forums for all that time, putting all of that together and going, you know, is it more likely than not that he would have been connected to somebody and let them know through a personal message, hey, I'm gonna be going live soon, I'm gonna be doing this, can you make sure that you get that recording? Because that recording and that live stream is been immensely influential in as a propaganda campaign, inspiring other people to violence and elevating his status within the extremist community to be somebody that was able to achieve what somebody had never been able to achieve. So that was really important to him and really effective as terrorism.
Lastly, we should talk about the inquiry. 3 days after the attack, a briefing document provided by the New Zealand Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet proposed that the inquiry should consider what the relevant government agencies knew or should have known about the terrorist in the lead up to the event. And this was how the Prime Minister repeatedly explained the scope of the inquiry to the media. But how was the scope of the inquiry changed, and how did this affect our ability to learn the lessons we needed to learn from this attack?
So the starting point, as was announced by the Prime Minister, was an inquiry into what the agencies could or should have known about the terrorist before his attack, i.e. a broad-ranging inquiry into what was he doing, what possibly could they have known, and what were the opportunities, if any, for his detection. So a broad-ranging inquiry, that was what was announced by the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister announced that because in the decision to hold an inquiry, there was a briefing paper from 2 government agencies, government departments, to Cabinet. In fact, there was just 4 members of Cabinet that were tasked with creating this inquiry. That initial briefing paper said what the agencies could or should have known. And the Prime Minister announced that around that time. But over a very brief period of about 2 or 3 weeks, as the terms of reference for the inquiry were finalised, that could or should have known was deleted and was replaced only with what the security agencies knew about the terrorist and what actions did they take in response to that knowledge, to that information, i.e. did they know anything? If the answer's no, then probably they don't need to do anything.
And mostly they found that they didn't know anything, and therefore they acted as well as they could have.
Exactly, but it's important to keep in mind that at that time, or like so about a month after the attack or so, the agencies already knew that they knew nothing. They already had looked and seen, did we know anything about this individual? No, we didn't. The terms of reference of a, and this is not just for our for this Royal Commission, but all New Zealand Royal Commissions, the terms of reference into the performance of government agencies are drafted in consultation with those agencies. Between drafted by several government agencies, sent to Cabinet for comment, sent back, a new iteration, sent out to agencies for consultation and for revision, and then a final document is drawn up. This is something that we highlight in the book, because if we want an inquiry into how something, the worst crime in New Zealand's history, could have happened, and could it possibly have been prevented, not so much to blame anybody, to blame any agencies or any individuals, then we need to focus on what could or should have been known. But that was removed through this consultation process. For us, it meant that the inquiry was incredibly narrow. It meant that we've learnt very little. You can, and as we do in the book, we compare it to inquiries into the terrorist attack in Norway and elsewhere, where there was a much more broad-ranging inquiry, there was much more criticism, and the country learnt a lot more. New Zealand was left with very little information and therefore nothing to change.
And importantly, it's the public perception of what was going to be investigated was really formulated in those early days. So, you know, the Prime Minister, the Minister of Police, the Police Commissioner, everybody was coming out saying no stone would be left unturned. You know, everybody recognised what an immense tragedy it was, and there was a huge outpouring of grief and love and support for the community. And that's so everybody had that demand of, well, we really need to understand what's happened here and learn from it. But within those sort of 3 or 4 weeks, those terms had changed. And then by the time the commission began its work, it had a very narrow task.
Which was never announced.
And
of course.
And, yeah, it was never changed.
The change was never announced.
Yeah, so the initial could or should have known was announced. Mm. The change was made. That was never announced. In fact, when the inquiry was formed and was announced, was established, the broad terms were still announced, even though the document that was being held in the hands of the Prime Minister said something very different. Even 17 months later, or how many, by the time that the report was finalised at the end of 2020, the final report was announced as if those broad terms had been at scope, when they hadn't that whole time. Not once was the New Zealand public told, or the community in Christchurch, the affected community or the families, not once was it told that those terms had been narrowed significantly. And this is something that New Zealand needs to reckon with. The worst ever crime in New Zealand's history has not been considered properly. New Zealand has not considered how it was able to happen. What are the changes we need to make to avoid an atrocity like this in the future? It's absolutely crucial that the job is done properly.
That was Dr. Chris Wilson and Mikhail Jevulski from the University of Auckland.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.